Hello and welcome in to eBible Fellowship Sunday afternoon questions and answers time, where you can interact with us with your questions and comments related to the Bible, and we'll try to respond as well as possible by going to the Bible. If you're calling us by phone, dial 209-647-1600 and then enter access code 181610, followed by the pound key, and that'll get you into conference. Then press star 6 and 1. If you're using Skype, simply press the free conference call button, then press your dial pad button and enter access code 181610, then press the pound key. And to get in line to ask a question, press star 6 and 1. If you're using Paltalk, go to eBible Fellowship's room, and once there, you can raise your hand, and when you're called on, you can ask your question. And now, with Sunday afternoon's questions and answers, here's Chris McCann.
All right. Welcome once again. Good evening to everyone. If anyone has anything, please raise your hand and contact us in the ways that were just outlined, and we'd be happy to discuss your question or to allow you to make your comment. Okay, we have someone on the phone. Welcome to our Sunday evening question and answer time.
Proverbs 27:18, who the fig tree represents. And I'll take my answer over the air. Thank you.
Proverbs 27:18. Okay. Whoso keepeth the fig tree shall eat the fruit thereof. So he that waiteth on his master shall be honored. And I'm not really sure. We know that the fig tree is used to typify Israel. For instance, in Joel, and it speaks of the enemies of God, or the king of Babylon, barking his fig tree. And also in the New Testament, Jesus cursed the fig tree so that there would be no fruit on it henceforward forever. And that identifies with God's curse upon national Israel when he rent the veil of the temple and they no longer were the holy people of God. On another level, that would point to the churches, who likewise are cursed at this point. So it's also possible for Christ to be in view as the fig tree. And I haven't looked at this particular verse, so I'm sorry I can't help you. But thank you for raising this verse. And let's go to our next caller. Welcome to our question and answer tonight.
Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Yes. My question, Chris, is about Hagar. I was just wondering who she might represent. That's one question. And the other thing is, do you think that she might have, I know she was from a pagan nation, Egypt, but do you think that to some degree she might have been a Christian? I think I read one portion of the Bible where it says that she wept and she cried. It sounded like she cried aloud, but it doesn't necessarily say she cried out to God. And then in the next verse, it doesn't say necessarily that God answered her, but it says something like God heard the lad.
Right.
So just curious, what is your take on that?
Well, person you're referring to, Hagar, was an Egyptian handmaid of Sarah, and Sarah gave her to her husband Abram to wife, and she had a child, Ishmael, who's the lad you're referring to. And God makes some interesting statements about Ishmael, where he indicates that he heard Abraham's prayer on Ishmael's behalf. And if you remember, the language in the book of Isaiah concerning the sons of Ishmael, and how we learned that God intended to save a good number of the descendants of Ishmael, who would be the Arab people. And so that's why it speaks of hearing the lad. I can't find the verse exactly. That was in Genesis 16 where she casts him under a tree. But there's other scriptures that point out how God says to Abraham that he has heard him in relationship to Ishmael. Now, as far as Hagar, she was not saved by everything we can read in the Bible. She's used by God to represent the law of God. In Galatians chapter 4, it says in verse 21, "Tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do ye not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman." The bondmaid spoken of here is Hagar, and the free woman would be Sarah. And it goes on to say, "But he who is of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman was by promise. Which things are an allegory? For these are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which gendereth to bondage, which is Agar. For this Agar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth or corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is in bondage with her children." Notice how many times the emphasis is placed on bondage. She's a bondmaid or a bondwoman, God speaks of her representing the covenant of Sinai, which gendereth to bondage, and Sinai is where the law was given. And so Hagar, who was an unsaved woman, came out of Egypt, and Egypt is known as a place where the Jews were kept in bondage. So it's no coincidence that she was an Egyptian. God uses her to illustrate the law and those that attempt to keep it. That's the one covenant. When people try to get right with God through the keeping of the law that was given at Sinai, this genders to bondage. It causes those who are involved in this attempt to become righteous through their own works to actually go deeper into a spiritual captivity or a spiritual bondage of their own sin. That's who Hagar represents, and she would absolutely have to be an unsaved woman.
Thank you, Chris. That's very, very clear. And just one other point on Hagar. In Genesis 16 also, Sarah, we know, gave her up to her husband. And then Sarah, of course, regretted this. But before Sarah regretted this, what do you think it means when it says that Hagar actually, after she conceived, she actually had issues with Sarah, so she was the one that started the, flaunting, maybe somebody would say, with flaunting, and sort of starting to act like she was the one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She despised Sarah after she conceived.
Well, keep in mind what we just read in Galatians. These are the two covenants, and God gave promise to Abram. The seed would come through Sarai or Sarah, and here she is, an old woman, barren, had never had a child, and suddenly her handmaid Hagar is given to and it practically right away she conceives and is with a child. So historically, we can see how this woman is feeling superior. In the few cases in the Bible we read about where there was this sort of jealousy, bearing children does tend to lead to a sort of pridefulness on the part of women who can, like Elkanah's one wife, and especially if the other woman, like Hannah, cannot. And same here, where Hagar was able to give birth, and Sarai is barren, and she's an old woman. There's no possibility. So Hagar is starting to think that her position in this household is taking on a much greater role because, well, she's bore a son, and her son will be the heir. And this, that's all on the physical level. Spiritually, we can see how those who are after the flesh, who are involved in works gospels, they tend to persecute those who follow the truth. They're waiting on the Lord, like Sarah, for God to fulfill his word and accomplish his purposes. And for a time, things don't look good. You know, that's been the story all through history for the people of God. If you look at them at certain points, things look very, very hopeless. It didn't look good for Sarai if you looked at her from an earthly perspective, and things didn't look good for David when he was approaching the giant. Things didn't look good for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they were going into the fiery furnace, and things definitely didn't look good for Daniel as he was thrown into a lion's den. And that is just a part of the story of the people of God. There will be times when the world is observing and they're thinking that they've won, that they've been victorious, that things are just insurmountable, impossible for the people of God. It's over. And the history of the Bible is that that's normally when God rises up and helps his people in a way that no one could foresee.
Thank you very much, Chris.
But thank you for your question. Let's go to the next person. Welcome to eBibles Question and Answer this Sunday night.
Ezekiel Carvalho asks, can you please explain Obadiah verses 15 through 18? Could those verses be referring to our time?
Obadiah is, let's see, it's right before Jonah. And 15 says, for the day of Jehovah is near upon all the heathen. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. For as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. Yea, they shall drink, and they shall swallow down. They shall be as though they had not been. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions, and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Jehovah has spoken it. I think it does. Especially this language of Jacob and Joseph being like a flame and Esau as stubble, that fits what we read in Malachi in chapter 4, verse 1. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith Jehovah of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. And Esau would be a synonym for the wicked. And the house of Jacob, the elect, are burning him up because at this time God has saved all the elect. And that fact that God has completed his salvation plan is the means by which he is bringing about judgment day. It's because he saved everyone that he intended to save that he could shut the door. And it's because all the names in the Lamb's Book of Life that were recorded have now become saved that God can open up the Book of Judgment. And he can judge mankind, and search can be made of all those under God's judgment, and their names will not be found in the Lamb's Book of Life. So in this spiritual sense, the elect are like a battle axe or a weapon of indignation in the Lord's hand that he is wielding in order to bring about the destruction of the unsaved. Of course, we're not doing anything. We would never do anything to harm anyone. That's not what God is saying. He's only using how he has worked upon us in saving us as a weapon. But we continue to live with our fellow man, and sometimes we don't know who's saved and who isn't. So we continue to treat everyone kindly and try to follow God's commandments in regards and relationships to all people and loving our neighbor. And we don't get into this. We don't point at anyone and say, well, now that person's no, that's not how God is judging the world with us. Basically, it's all his action, and he's using us, utilizing us as a weapon, but we're just continuing on living our lives. But thank you for those verses. And do we have another question from Pal Talk?
Yes. Trust in the Lord asks, I need help in understanding a few of the many questions that arise out of Judges chapter 19. In an old open forum, Harold Camping mentioned that Judges 19 refers to the end of the church age, but does not explain the connection. Can you explain these questions? And here's some of these states. He states that in this context, the four, which I think he's speaking of verse 2, where the concubine of the Levite was in Bethlehem, Judah for four whole months. He says that the four points to the furthest extent in time. So, does it apply to the end of this judgment day period of our present day? If so, what does the message of the husband cutting up the concubine into 12 pieces and sending them to the 12 tribes mean? The evil that was done to the man and his concubine happened in the land of the Benjaminites, not all of Israel.
Excuse me.
Also, is it that the tribes have become as a beast, as the heathen world shown as a cut-up animal? And is there a connection with the similar reference of Sodom and Gomorrah noted in Judges 19, verses 22 to 24, and the punishment that went to the four cities, which can be looked at as to warn the entire world of the judgment to come?
Well, I think we would have to look at Judges 19 as information related to the judgment on the churches. And, you know, when we read of Mount Ephraim and Bethlehem, Judah, and Jerusalem and all these places, and Benjamin. These are places that identify with the churches. Now, for instance, compare that to Isaiah 24, where it says earth, 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 some 15 times, and world. So there we know accurately that it's not the church, it's the world. And so in Judges 19, God is describing the awful mess that the churches became during the Great Tribulation. Levite and his concubine, he was in Israel. A point of that is made that he wasn't outside of Israel amongst the heathen, but this terrible thing happened within the land of Israel. Such a thing had never been heard of before. And as a result of this, the cutting up of the concubine, and this man sending pieces to all the tribes, they gathered together in order to destroy Benjamin, and they almost succeed. And it's infighting, a civil war, and that's a accurate portrayal of the churches. Denomination against denomination, doctrine against doctrine, and these ugly events in Judges 19, they relay to us the spiritual ugliness of the churches during the Great Tribulation. And that's why it's summed up in Judges 21, verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So the king is Christ, and Israel would be representative of the corporate churches. So when Christ departed out of the midst of the congregations, there was no king in Israel. And as a result, we have speaking in tongues spread like wildfire, falling over backwards, holy laughter, women preachers and bishops, homosexual bishops and priests, and on and on and on. It was chaos within the church world because everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes, according to the minds of men, and God had forsaken them and left them, and they had no king. But thank you for your question and bringing up those verses. Are there any other questions from Pal Talk?
Yes. Unprofitable asks, if you look at Daniel chapter 12, verses 10 to 13, the question about that selection is, what does the 1,305 and 30 days refer to?
All right, let's take a look at Daniel 12:10. Many shall be purified and made white and tried. Now, that verse we haven't read for quite a while, but it is describing what is going on today. There is a trial of faith and a purifying. How is one purified? Well, you take the gold and the silver, and you put it into the fire in order to purify it. So both the purifying and making white would be reference to being made white through the righteousness of Christ and having that salvation tried. And then it goes on to say, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. This verse is just as true today as it was 2 years ago. It is the people of God identified as wise, like the wise virgins, who understand the information that has been opened up from the scriptures, and yet none of the wicked, none of the foolish virgins understand. And this is how God has arranged things. And then it goes on to say in verse 11, and from the time that the daily sacrifices in italics shall be taken away, and the abomination maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. And this is a little complicated, and I don't know if we can get into it, but you may remember Mr. Camping writing about this in some of his books, that there is a space of time between the between these historical types of the abomination of desolation that matches this 1290. It's 1290 years from 1877 BC, which was this after 2 years of the famine in Joseph's day, and the time when Jacob and his family would enter into Egypt. And that 7-year famine typified the Great Tribulation, according to Acts 7. So from that point of 1877 BC, if you go 1290 years, it comes to 587 BC. And that was the 23rd year inclusively from the beginning of the Babylonian judgment period of 609 BC to 539. From 609 to 587 was 22 years, but 23 years inclusively. And that 1290 is what's in view from the setting up of abominations, because in 587, the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed, just as in 1877, when Jacob left the land of Canaan, for all intents, the land of Canaan, representative of God's kingdom, was destroyed. And then Mr. Camping points out that 1290 is actually 3 times 430, because from 1877 BC, when Jacob entered into Egypt, it was exactly 430 years later that they came out in the Exodus of 1447 BC. And so in multiplying that number by 3, 430 times 3, it equals 1290, and it fell on 587. So Mr. Camping, he just wondered, well, what if we multiply 1290 by 3? And if you do, I think it turns out to be 3,870, and it falls on the year 1994. And 1994 also happens to be in the midst of the actual Great Tribulation period, like the other two dates were in the midst of types and figures of the Great Tribulation. But 1994 was 2,300 days into that 23-year Great Tribulation, and once again, the abomination of desolation is in view. So that's very interesting how that all relates. And then it goes on to say in verse 12, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 and 30 days. Now that 1335, we are tempted to try and relate it to the 1290, maybe add an additional 45 years here or there, 450 years or something like that. But no matter how you try to do that, it doesn't fit. It doesn't work out. And so finally, you know, we just realize, well, this isn't the way to go. And so once again, you know, referring back to Mr. Camping to give proper credit, he demonstrated, he showed, how that the 1,335 days fits the time period of Christ's ministry exactly. And that's where the 1,335 days should go. And that's why it says, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh. And if you recall, when Jesus was entering into Jerusalem, they were crying out, blessed is he who cometh in the name of the Lord. And so this verse does have application to that. And then verse 13, but go thou thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. And this would be referring to the end of the time that God has stipulated for judgment day at the end of this period. Just as he said to Daniel, would stand in his lot. The lot is another way of saying inheritance. And so Daniel would receive his inheritance at the end of the days, the inheritance of a new heaven, a new earth, and eternal life. And so will each true believer, each child of God, receive our lot, our eternal inheritance, at the end of the days. And that's what we're waiting on. We're waiting on the Lord to bring that about. But thank you for bringing up these verses. And I would like to thank everyone, as we've come to the end of our time tonight, I'd like to thank you for sharing your questions and your comments, and especially for the Bible verses we had an opportunity to read and consider. Lord willing, we'll be back again tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time until 9:30 for a Bible study in the book of 1 Samuel. And each night this week, 9 to 9:30, Friday nights, Friday evenings at 9:30, we'll have another question and answer. But for now, I'll say good night, and may the Lord's perfect will be done.
And thank you for joining us here on eBible Fellowship Sunday Afternoon Questions and Answers Time. You can hear this broadcast each and every Sunday around 1 o'clock Eastern. And don't forget, you can also join us for yet another live Questions and Answers Time Friday evenings at about 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Until then, have a pleasant Sunday afternoon, and may the Lord's perfect will be done.